History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there in your neighborhood that should not go untold. We found out about the veteran we're going to meet today from one of his neighbors in Grover Beach, California. Paul James got to accompany 89-year-old Tom Davis on an honor flight to Washington, D.C., and he heard a pretty remarkable story of survival from this Purple Heart recipient. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know we hear almost exclusively from veterans of World War II on this program. Some of them, of course, also served in the Korean War and some even in Vietnam. But I'm often asked when and if I'll move on to veterans of the Korean War, whose stories can be just as intense and meaningful, of course. And my answer generally is that I'll keep talking to World War II vets as long as they're around to tell their stories. The reality, of course, is that veterans of the Korean War aren't much younger than those who served in World War II, and that conflict itself has been so overlooked that it's even been dubbed the Forgotten War. Well, we're going to hear about how one man from the 1st Cavalry Division experienced the Korean War today, but as always, I'd like to start a little earlier on in the chronology, and just like World War II vets, just about every Korean War veteran has a memory of December 7th, 1941. So Tom, what's yours? I guess you were all of 12 years old?
The day the Japanese attacked it. We are hunting wild pigeons in Cuella Meca in Southern California. And my grandfather and I were walking back from hunting, and the news came over that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese, and we said we got to get out of here right now because he was vice president of the Southern California Edison Company, and we had to get back right now. So in Balboa at that time, we had a little boat that we could go to Catalina Inn back and forth that my grandfather owned and my dad built. But anyway, he gave that to the Navy to right away so they could have it for guarding our coast. And so that was one of the things he did for them. So that was kind of interesting.
I bet you had had some adventures on that boat.
Oh, yes. I had went to Catalina and quite a bit and everything else, fished and everything off of that thing. But the most interesting thing I had, hard to understand how something can come up in your childhood and not know anything about it other than what took place right at that point in time. And that Pearl Harbor took place, and Christmas is not too far away from that. So we always spent Christmas with my grandfather. Well, I was there at my grandfather's house for Christmas dinner and everything else, and the doorbell rang, and there was a guy that a taxi had brought him there, and he said to my grandfather, "Can you pay the taxi driver?" And he was the captain of one of the boats that were turned over in Pearl Harbor, and he was in an insane asylum here. They put him in there because they didn't want him to tell anything. And he was telling my grandfather, and I'm 12 years old, listening to this story, and he said that Roosevelt knew that the Japanese were coming. And he was mad because he said they could have got us all out of there without any problem at all. And got us out in the open waters, and we wouldn't have been all killed like they got killed there. He was furious. And then it wasn't more than 10 minutes went by, it seems like, and the Army showed up and said, "He's crazy. We got to get him back to the crazy house." And I can remember that, and it all took place when I was just a young kid. Now, I never forgot that.
So this guy was a friend of your grandfather's or something?
Yes, he was. And I don't know what his relationship was with my grandfather, but he knew that my grandfather was an important person, and he wanted to tell him what was going on, you know, and I don't understand it, but I can remember that when my childhood. I look at the things that happened, and I end up going into the service, and I go through basic training, and they give you a rifle. This rifle has to be taken care of and everything else, and as soon as I'm out of basic training, they take it away from you. And I go up to Sacramento and wait for the trip to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. And They gave me a new rifle, brand new rifle. It cost me, and I had to clean the whole thing. As soon as I got on the ship, they took it away from me again. I get to Japan, and they give me a brand new one again, and I had to clean it all up and everything else and go out and target practice and shoot it in. And when I got to Korea, they took it away from me again. I never saw the same rifle ever again until I got to... I ended up with a BAR, an automatic rifle then, when I got in combat.
Well, and I want to hear about combat, but there was another palpable way that December 7th changed your life. You had been living in Venice in Southern California, right on the coastline?
In Venice, where Playa del Rey, I was living on the coast there, up on the hillside there, and what happened was the army came in with a big cannon and put it on the hillside, thinking that the Japanese would try to hit the shorelines, and so they'd have this cannon sit at the end of the block from my street. My mother says, "No, I think we better get out of here because I don't think this is safe for us." So otherwise, I'd have still probably be in Los Angeles area. But we moved into L.A. area and further in town, so we'd be safer. But the Japanese never did hit the shoreline there. But I went to Venice School in Venice there called Nightingale Grammar School. I became a junior lifeguard.
And I know we're going to talk about the Korean War, but I have a few more questions about that World War II period. Other than having to move inland because what was happening was spooking your mother a little bit, did you notice life changing around Southern California after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yes. After Pearl Harbor, it changed quite a bit. The shorelines, everything was all guarded by military. And so it was sort of a military area there completely. The reason where Playa del Rey is and Manhattan Beach, in between the two areas, there's a shipping lane that came in there and brought oil in. So that was quite a worry, too, for us, because you'd think the Japanese would try to sink those oil tankers coming in. They were worried about it all. That whole coastline there was guarded quite heavily with the army and everything. The main airport down there, that's where they made all the P-38s and everything else. They flew right over by our house, and we could see them flying out. And that was the first time I ever saw a flying wing that they had. They had one fly out, and I saw it fly up over the house, and it was quite high. But it was kind of interesting to see all the military stuff going out. So my family was really worried about, my mother was really worried, and we better get out of here, but this is not a safe place to be. So that's why we moved into L.A. I didn't like moving in because I used to love the water and everything else down there.
What about, had you had in school any Japanese-American friends before that?
I had Japanese friends, but they were my grandfather's and my grandmother's. She had a Japanese maid and a Japanese gardener, and the Famiko is in their name, and they had to take them away and put them in the concentration camp at that time. And so I missed them then because they were good friends of ours.
So you experienced all of World War II as a kid and then a teenager in Southern California. Do you remember what it was like when all of those civilians in L.A. found out, hey, the war is over, the Allies have won, and what had been a good chunk of your life to that point, you didn't have to worry about anymore?
Well, we didn't think we'd have to worry about it anymore because it was all over with. That was quite a celebration they had, you know, and then everybody came back home, and the ones that were still alive came back home anyway. But I had no idea that we were going to get ourselves into another one right away, but it one ends and we were right back into Korea. It was President Truman who got us into that one, and MacArthur there. I was disappointed that he took MacArthur out of that because he had it won. He was doing a good job until then, and then all of a sudden we ended up with a halfway done job and never did finish the job right.
And as I understand it, when the Korean War started, you didn't think that you were going to be a part of this. You didn't think the army was going to want you or would take you if you wanted to go?
I never thought I'd have to go, but situation came about where they were drafting everybody, and so everybody and all my friends were joining the National Guard, so they thought that way they'd stay here and not end up, because they were supposed to be in California, and stay here in California, and they'd be safer that way, and they all ended up over there anyway. So I ended up before they got there. I was there before they got there.
But you want to tell me why you didn't think they would take you?
I was involved in racing and everything else, and racing boats, and a friend of mine had a boat, and I got to play with it quite a bit, and down at Marine Stadium, and it's a hydroplane, and it was a four-cylinder Ferguson engine in the darn thing with all welded up and differently. It had four ports in it and everything else. Anyway, to make a long story short, it had a fire extinguisher. You could break the handle off of it, and it would squirt carbon tetrachloride. Well, I broke it off by accident, and it went off in my face and got me in my eyes and everything else. And I tried to wash everything out, and I ended up with carbon tetrachloride poisoning, which they thought it was jaundice. And so they said that my doctor said they'd never take you in the Army because you got jaundice. And so when I went down to the Army, the doctors were all standing there taking all these guys in. And this doctor, I handed him the paper, and it's, he looked at it, and he says, "You look fine. You're in the Army." That quick. So I didn't have any choice. I didn't even have a chance to go back home even. That was it. And I was changed clothes, and that was it.
But that's after all your buddies have signed up for the National Guard, which you probably would have done if you hadn't believed they wouldn't take you.
Yeah.
Then they end up drafting you after all. What'd they do with you? Tell me what the training was like and what kind of outfit they put you in.
They put me in the on a bus and shipped me to San Luis Obispo area. Well, actually, it's up there by about 50 miles north of Paso, and I was out in the desert. And as far as I was concerned, I had no idea where in the hell I was. But anyway, the Army was there. They had the training, and we went through training. And it was first of all, we had to go take a test, and that was about a 2-hour test. And that was kind of crazy. And you have this 2-hour test and everything else, paperwork all over the place, and they take you away from there and go on into the training. And I never knew what the hell the test was all about and why they even had the test, you know. They didn't say anything, you know, until it was kind of crazy, you know. You got went through basic training and everything else, and all of a sudden they bring you out. And after you finish your basic training, target practicing and everything, and they brought us out at attention, and we're all standing there at attention. They start calling people's names out, and they called my name out, and they said half of them were called out, and the other half didn't get called out. And then they said, "You're entitled to go to officer candidate school. You're graduated. When you took that test, you got 80% on it, so you can go to officer candidate school." And I said, "Well, that sounds like a nice idea." So they said, "But you're going to have to give up the 2 years you're going in for. You're going to go in for 4 years." And I said, "No, I don't think I want to stay here. 2 years is long enough." So I refused the opportunity to go into officer candidate school. And that was a mistake, maybe, because they sent me immediately overseas.
Whereas, had you accepted officer candidate school, maybe by the time you finished all that, the Korean War would have been over?
Yes, the war would have been over by the time. Anyway, I wouldn't have probably gone over there as an officer anyway. But if I imagine 4 years in there, if you're going to go in for four, you might as well stay in the rest of the time, because 4 years of becoming an officer is wasted time. You might as well stay in the rest of the time, because the Army isn't that bad. So I would say that would be a good way to stay in the Army. I didn't think it was more like jail at first, and so I didn't want to be involved in it.
And that decision that you made almost cost you your life.
That's correct. It did. I got over to Japan, and from Japan, I went to Korea, and then Korea, they sent me over to the front, right to the front lines.
And we're going
to
hear what he experienced on those front lines when we come back. Tom Davis, 89 years old, of Grover Beach, California, is our guest today. Find photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing, close to to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.